This is Oral History Interview Number 47, recorded with Al Fletcher on July 10th, 1997.
Well, in the early days, see, my dad came up here. He came in 1907, and that's the year that the Mounties came to look for gunmen, the famous Indian that shot the two white guys in 2 miles.
Yep.
And he came, he wasn't a Mountie, but he came in the wintertime with them. They had dog teams, and they walked all the way from Big Blue Potatoes, snowshoes. Because they used to bring the mail from Rupert and by donkey in 1907. And so that's when he came here first. And then he came back in 1913 and then started ranching.
So going back a little bit, before you started pack train, you said you did horse logging?
Yeah, I worked in the sawmills. In the early days, you know, I thought, you know, it seemed like things were better then, I don't know, but there wasn't so many people in the valley, but they didn't have any of these great big clear cuts. The bush was full of little sawmills, and most of them were horse loggers. The odd one had a tractor and stuff. But all these little sawmills up, they do me like my partner and I, we had a little sawmill up Turkey Creek in 1947. And there were just two of us, and we hired two other guys, but we only paid $2 an hour for wages, and $1.50 a thousand stumpage for timber. And we worked all there all winter. Here comes that rain. And that was during the war, and the lumber prices were pretty good, you know. We got $80 a thousand for planks. 2x6s, 2x8s, 2x10s, and stuff like that. And I started in October when the first snow came, and I quit in March, and I had $1,800 in the bank. And I went into the General Motors garage and bought a brand new Pontiac coupe, 1947 Pontiac coupe for $1,800. So, and everybody was working in the bush, and some of the little bigger ones would have 10 guys and maybe a tractor or something, a little cat and lifted horses. So. But they never hurt anything in the bush when you're logging the horses. When they got those big cats, you go in the bush. Every time a big cat turned around to get a log, he'd knock down 6 or 8 little trees that are coming up. And then they hire guys to go and replant them again. But these big clear cuts too, you know, I think it, some places it creates a lot of runoffs too, and especially on steep side hills, and then they get runoffs of mud running into some of these streams that are producing fish. So now they got the bushes. There's one of them forestry guys behind every stump now. Every time you go out in a bush, you can't turn around, you can't, if you make a muddy track, well, they shut you down. And You can't cut a tree within 100 yards of the creek, which is good. But they've got so many regulations now. Well, look what the escape we're in here now. You know, thousands of guys are being laid off work because the pulp mill is shut down. Smithers is shutting down tomorrow. Recap is shutting down, and 200 guys no job. But if they'd kept, well, they can't stop progress.
Yeah.
The horse logging in those days, it seemed so simple and easy and good for the country, and now it seemed like we're getting in a little trouble.
Let's put it right there. Okay, so go ahead if you want to start telling me about the pack trains.
Yeah, well, 30s, in the Depression times, so about 1936, 37, started in the packing inside a bunch of horses. And there was an old packer, but he was quite a famous old packer from the States. He lived over in Driftwood Canyon, and he was about 50 years old, and I was only about 16 at the time, but he taught me how to pack. He used to let me take his pack train in the mountains. He was the old prospector. He'd pack it up, and let me go just as a kid, you know, and take the horses up and then load them and bring them home. So that's how it got started. But then after I got around, when I was around 21, I guess I had about 6 or 7 head of pack horse an hour. And then I got a job packing for the government survey at McDonald Lake. And they had a survey crew in there. They were surveying for a dam site on the Copper River. So I had a job that summer packing all the supplies from the old Luthy mine to McDonald Lake. It was just a pack tour of 13 miles, but I made a trip every day packing groceries. So I did that that summer. And then I used to pack for all the old prospectors, quite a few old prospectors in the Babines in the under 30. They were just roaming around the mountains looking for ore and had camps. And the Mesners had a camp at Silver King Basin and packed for them. And Tommy King and Martin Kane. And so I got to know all the Babines, all the trails. All the camps bus and everything, and that's a good life, but you only got $2 a day for horses and $5 a day for myself. But in the Hungry 30s, you know, for even $8 or $10 a day, you could buy something. You know, I had a family, a wife, and a boy, and we could live on what I was making. In the wintertime, I trapped every winter for about 20 years in the Babines. I had a trap register trap line, so I trapped in the wintertime and packed in the summertime. It was a good life. Didn't make any money, but happy as heck.
Mm-hmm. If we can go back a bit to the horse packing that you did. You said you did it in the 30s?
Yeah. All the way. I started, I think, about 1938 I started, and I quit about 1949 was my last year. I packed that year, and then I was guiding in the fall, in the summertime in pack, and hunting in the fall for the American hunters.
And you did a lot of the trails mostly in the Babine area then, packing?
Yeah, I did all my packing in the Babines, except the summer I packed for the government survey at McDonald Lake, and that's behind it. That's a big glacier.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what made me so upset, because in the year my dad came here in 1970, another guy cut the trail to Tubers Lake, and that's where I got the goat name.
Mm-hmm.
And then I packed it there for an old prospector by the name of Frank DeLong. Mm-hmm. He had some mining property there, so I packed for him there. And all the trails in the Babines, every trail was cut and made by horse people.
I was asking about Hazleton,
the old famous pack trains are like Cataline.
Mm-hmm.
He had a pack train running out of Hazleton. That's the year my dad came up. Cataline was running a pack train from Hazleton. He had up to, I think, 40-50 mules.
Mm-hmm.
And he used to, that's when they were building the telegraph trail from Hazleton to Yukon. And he did all this. They had cabins every 10 miles, and he used to pack in all the grub and stuff and supply all these cabins every fall with enough grub, so there'd be a couple of guys staying in each cabin all winter to keep the line open, keep it in case a tree fell on it or
mm-hmm.
something. So that's called the Telegraph Trail from Hazleton to Yukon, I guess, and that's where it was headed.
Mm-hmm.
And then I guess I can't remember exactly, but I think it was shortly after they got it built, and then they got the Morse code, I guess, and then they didn't need the telephone.
Yeah.
But there were some famous packers in Houston in the early days. George Burns was another famous packer. He had a ranch up to Kiss the Ox, and a lot of horses. He packed and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But you must have some pictures in the archives of the old pack trains in Hazleton.
Yeah, right? Yeah, we have a few of Cataline.
Yeah.
The pack trains were mostly done in the summer and not in winter?
No, they couldn't go in the winter.
Yeah.
Well, they had to get all that grub in there in the fall to keep these here cabins supplied for the winter so the guys would have something to eat during the spring.
Mm-hmm.
And then, the snow gets so deep, you can't pack in the wintertime anyway.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of history around here. That's why I was born in 1918.
The what was the hospital called then?
Lynch Memorial Hospital.
Yeah, after the doctor.
Doctor.
Yeah.
Quite a famous doctor. Yeah. And all the trails in the Babines, every trail was cut and made by hospital. And then all of a sudden, a few years ago, they come along and say, we've made it a park, and you can't take horses anymore, except the Silver King Basin. Mm-hmm. But the other trails, they went and put signs on them, no horses allowed. So then I went to see the head of the park branch, and I said, I'm a little upset about those new signs you got up on those trails in the Babines. I said, my dad, I've been packing and guiding there and trapping all my life, and they said, all of a sudden there's a big sign up. You can't take a horse on the trail that's been made by horse people. Mm-hmm. Oh, well, a lot of these hikers, they don't like to see them. They don't like that horse from running the trail. They don't like the horse going through the mud holes because it makes it muddy. So I said, well, I said that sign, those signs don't apply to me. Mm-hmm. She said, what do you mean? Well, I said, I'm going to ride right past him on the horse because I'm going to go.
Yep.
So he didn't know what to say, and then we talked about it a long time, and I argued with him. And finally he said, well, how would you like to be an honorary park ranger? So I said, well, that means I can take my horse? Oh, yeah, I can take my horse.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a pretty good agreement that I'm an honorary park ranger.
Yeah.
And last year they named that trail. That there was like, there's a big sign so, at Sunny Point,
mm-hmm.
at the end of the road there, where you start to drive, and then you can go, you can take a horse up to Silver King, but the big sign there said you can't take a horse to Tubers Lake.
Mm-hmm.
And they Lefty Gardner was a friend of mine, he guided a little bit there, and his wife, he died a couple years ago, but his wife was there last year too. And they had a little bit of a do at some point there, and they put up a big metal sign with all the history, and they named it the Fletcher Gardner Trail.
Mm-hmm. So you said that the trail that the Fletcher Gardner went, your father and Lefty Gardner?
No, my father, Lefty Gardner, didn't go in there until after I did.
Oh, okay.
But my father and another guy spent all one summer there cutting that trail,
mm-hmm.
for a mining company. So it was nice that we got some recognition for that.
How long is the trail?
Oh, it's about 8 miles,
mm-hmm.
from Sunny Point to Tubers Lake. And then there's two trails, about a mile from Tubers Lake. One trail goes down to the lake, and but there's no grass down there for horses, so the other trail goes up to Timberland. There's a nice meadow there with the creek.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where every fall when I went there. And two or three different falls. I took my boss from Vancouver, his name was Al West, he was in charge of pressure control. He used to come up and fall, take the pack train and go in there and hunt goats for you.
Mm-hmm.
Well then, that was in 1949, I was still packing, and then that's when I started guiding too. And then that's the fall I got the boys for the goat.
Mm-hmm. Well, why didn't you tell me again about the story about the goat?
Well, it was a guy from Ohio. His name was Ernest Hawes, and I just started guiding. I'd been guiding. This was the second year of guiding, I guess. And I don't know where he got. He must have got my name out of some government list of guides somewhere. So he picked me anyway. He'd hunted all over the world, but so him and his wife came up from Ohio, and I had the ranch over there, and she stayed at the ranch with my wife. We took the pack train and went into Babines. And getting $20 a day from the saddle and four horses. Now they get $10,000 for a 10-day hunt.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's the old days. So anyway, we got in there, and the first day of rain, so we went fishing for one day and caught some trout. And the next day, it started to lift a little bit. Still cloudy, but it wasn't raining, and some fog up in the mountains. So we started up this year a big mountain in behind the camp at Tubers Lake. And it took us about a couple hours. He wasn't in very good shape. He couldn't climb very good. He was out of shape. So So he was scared of grizzly bears. He had a 30-yard section of scope. He was worried about grizzly bears that the 30-yard section wasn't big enough. So he got this 375 mag, big heavy gun. So I got a lug that long, plus a pair of binoculars, just in case he met a grizzly. So we get up to the top of the mountain and we're sitting in, just on this ridge. And he was popping and heaving. Yeah, this goat walked out on the ridge in front of us and stood on the kind of skyline, but it was pretty foggy and wonderful. And he just walked out there and stood there for a second or two, and we saw him. And the guy grabbed his rifle and he was going to shoot. But the goat turned and was going straight away from us, you know. And he was shaking so bad, and I said, don't shoot. Because I said, you're going to shoot him in the rear end and maybe just cripple him. And I said, we've got to get a better shot than this. And so I said, we just got to go around the little gully there and get over to where the goat was. I think the goat must have heard us or smelled us, because when we got over to where he was standing, he was about 200 yards away by this time. And he's trotting down this big mountain, the face of this mountain. He's going pretty good trot. And so I said, well, you got to start shooting, because the last chance he's getting away. So the second shot, just by accident, he broke a front leg on. Mm-hmm. And then the goat went a little bit farther, and there was a chute, a low glacier there, was a cut in the rocks there, and the goat went in there to hide, because he's shooting, shooting one after the other.
Yeah.
And he kept shooting at him. And then the goat ran in that gully, and then every once in a while the goat would stick his head out, because he wanted to keep going up the mountain, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But so every time he stuck his head out, well, by that time he's 400 yards away, and the guy was even lucky to hit the side of the mountain at the goat, you know, and he never touched him. He fired 32 shots altogether, mm-hmm. and never touched him again. And so I said, well, we're just about out of shells. I only got one shell left from this 375, because he was shooting both guns when I'm reloading for him. So I said, we only got one shell left. I said, I got to go down there after that goat. He's in that chute.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a couple of shells left for the 30-06, so I said, don't waste them. I said, wait, it's going to take me half an hour to climb down the side of the mountain. And so I said, well, you know, let me get down there probably halfway before you waste any more shells. But I hadn't gone more than 100 yards and he shot both shells, so I said, mm-hmm. now we're down to one shell.
Yeah.
So I was in a hurry and as fast as I could, and I jumped into a little chute that was full of ice, and the gravel went shooting down this gully. Curtain went over the edge of a cleft, climbed out the other side, and the goat heard the rocks rolling.
Mm-hmm.
And he was about 100 yards away, hiding in that chute, but when he heard the rocks rolling, he got scared and he ran out in front of me. He was running across a big snowfield about 100 yards away, 100 yards in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
And shot him in the rear end when he was running away from me. The last shell I had.
Yeah.
But it's a good thing I didn't know he was a world record. I might have got Buck Beaver and missed him. But that was it.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy sitting up there 500 yards away on top of the cliff watching me with a binocular, he saw me. When he saw the goat go down, and I started skinning him over,
mm-hmm.
he went back down the hill back to camp. And I couldn't get back up that mountain because the hide in the head weighed 65 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
And had his rifle and a pair of binoculars. And it took me, an hour or so to get that goat skinned out. And then I had to go around another range of mountains to get back to camp,
mm-hmm.
because I couldn't climb that steep one.
Yeah.
So I had visions at 5 o'clock at night, and I was dead tired. And I had visions and, the campfire would be going, the coffee pot's going, and maybe clean the fish, and we're going to have fish for supper.
Yeah.
I get back to camp, and he's sitting on his bedroll, no fire, didn't have a fire going, the fish were still hanging in the creek on a string, never watered the horses, and the horses would pick it up in the meadow, but you got to take them to the creek for a drink.
Mm-hmm.
And no fire going, not even a cup of coffee. And he got all excited when he saw that goat, because he's hunted all over the world, I guess. And he said, I think we've got a record book goat here. So he said, we've got to celebrate tonight. And I said, what do you mean? Well, there's no prospect there for the name of Frank DeLong that he used to pack for. He had a cabin there. Always said, we're going to ask Frank to come over for supper. He said, because we've got a bunch of fish to cook. But he never offered to clean the fish or cook the supper or light the fire or do nothing. But he goes over and asks this guy for supper, which I didn't really need after.
Yeah.
I was so damn tired, I could hardly stand up. I got to cook supper for him and Frank DeLong. Mm-hmm. Celebrating because we got a big goat. So I came home and then he shipped it away and wasn't only a couple of weeks or so. The record, world's record before that was taken in 1927. Mm-hmm. And so that was 1949, so 20 years since it's been broken. Mm-hmm. And then it wasn't a couple of weeks later I get word from him that it's a world record. Mm-hmm. So at 1949, that's pretty 50 years and nobody's broken.
Yeah.
I don't know. With a lot of records are made to be broken. I guess someday maybe somebody will break them. But it's 50 years, a pretty good record.
And you said that he never gave you any of the credit for it.
No. He wrote the story in Outdoor Life magazine, and he told how he shot the three shots and how he was climbing a ridge, just hanging on by his fingernails, and the wind was howling. He couldn't have got blown off. And he got within a couple hundred yards and he got to go for the third shot. He forgot about mentioning the other three. The third shot. He never gave me any credit at all, but then understand.
Yeah.
You know, what kind of a story would it look like if he told the truth? You know?
Yeah. Then in a lot of ways you're getting revenge now because they're making the bronze out of it here in Smithers. Yeah.
And he's dead and I'm going to be here when they unveil the gold.
Yeah. And you said it's going to be placed out on the lawn in front of the Central Park building? And then they're selling the small statues up there?
Beg your pardon?
They're selling the small statues.
Like yeah, they sell them for $2,100. Mm-hmm. And I got one and I ordered another one. But they make also the white and then they make, you can have your choice, you can have a white or straight bronze. Mm-hmm. So I talked to a sculptor the other day and he's coming up in October. But I told him, I said, well, I'd like to get one more because they've got a few left. But I said, next one I want a straight bronze. Mm-hmm. So the big one in front of the courthouse is going to be a light bronze so that it reflects the sun when the sun shines on.
Yeah.
Well, that'd be nice. Mm-hmm. I'm looking forward to that day. Mm-hmm.
So when you got that goat, did you use the Fletcher Garden Trail? Was it up that way?
Yeah, that's the trail we made. Yeah. That's the trail I went up. So that's kind of a famous trail I went up. That was in 1949. I was still packing, and then that's when I started guiding too. And then that's the fall I got the world's record goat. So then I only got a chance. I like guiding too, but I only got a chance to guide for 2 or 3 years. And then I was going on a pack trip in Baboon for some tourists to take pictures in the Silver King Basin with the fish and wildlife. The head guy from Prince George and the local game warden up his name was Les Cox, they come driving up behind me and stopped me and asked me if I wanted to go to work for the Fish and Wildlife. And I said, well, I don't know, I'm having a pretty good time. I don't know about that, I'll have to think about that. And they wanted me just for predator control alone because the wolves were getting so thick. Where did I stop?
We were just talking about working for the Fish and Wildlife.
Oh, yeah.
Where you were.
Yeah, because when I was trapping one winter and packing in the summertime, and in the fall, the wolves killed 6 head of my cattle one fall. So, of course, then I got mad at them and I got a permit to use strychnine and with trapping and poison. I got 4 of them wolves that winter, so that's how I got started. Getting after wolves because the wolves were getting thicker and acting, killing lots of game. So then the Fish and Wildlife said, at that time there was $25 bounty game, mm-hmm. and Alberta had a $4 bounty. So you can know, you imagine what's happened. Every wolf killed in Alberta was being smuggled across the border into BC to collect $25. So the government said, well, this has got to stop. We're paying out thousands every year for killing Alberta wolves, so we're going to do away with the bounty system, and we're going to hire 4 guys in BC as predator hunters. And so I was the third one. I was the second or third one higher. And so then when they told me, you know, they were offering me a government job, and they're going to give me a vehicle, and a sleeping bag, and a pair of binoculars, and a 30-30 rifle, and I was thinking about that. So then that fall I decided, well, sounded pretty good. Got all my clothes too, got a uniform and everything, and traveling expenses. So I took the job in 1952, and then I kept it until 1966. And I had pretty near a quarter of British Columbia covered, but mostly by airplane in the wintertime. And all the way from Friedman Park to Telegraph Creek and from Indaco to Prince Rupert. So, but 16 years, there was a lot of scary times, you know, two or three times that never should have been lived through. Some hitting some storms, some whiteout, an airplane going up near the Telegraph Creek, lost in a snowstorm for a couple hours, and up in the fire flats and head of the Mosquito River and the Beaver, and just circling around and around in the snowstorm trying to, you can't see nothing. Eh?
Yeah.
And run out of old gasoline was starting to go down. And you're looking for a break so you can see a peak somewhere. But those bush pilots were good. If they could spot a mountain they recognized, they'd fly to it and then find a river and then move them. Oh, they had a Bear Lake and spotted a mountain there, and then we followed the Bear River down to the Skeena, and then they came out of Hazleton, just flying, you know, a couple hundred feet off the deck all the way down because it's moving so bad. Oh, yeah. Lots of narrow escapes and this bush plane. Interesting life, and you met a lot of new people. And you got to work with them. There was a good game board in Burns Lake. I used to work down there in the fall doing road checks. And him and I got on real good, so we had lots of good time down there too. So then when I quit the fishing wildlife, 1966, and then I just went back to raising cattle. Raising cows. Well, I had some cattle during the winter. I had the first one that job. I told him when I took the job, I said, if I have to move to town, sell the ranch, I said, you can keep it. I don't want it, but if I could. I said, if I can keep the ranch and I get a month's holiday in the summertime, I can put up my hay and I can keep some cows. I said, if that's not a deal, well, I don't know. And I said, okay. So that's what I did. Right up until now, I guess. Oh, yeah, there's a lot of characters up the Kitchbrook Valley. Because when I worked for Fish and Wildlife, I got to know all the ranchers. And there's quite some famous characters like Ted Campbell. One story I'll never live down, when I worked for Fish and Wildlife, Campbell's had trouble with the wolves were killing some sheep, so I went up there one day, got there about 10 o'clock in the morning, and old Ted was sitting in the house and his feet up on the stove and the coffee pot torn, and he called his wife, Hun, and he said, well, Hun's out in the barn doing the chores, he said, and you better have a cup of coffee, and I said, well, we better put some bait out for the wolves. Oh, that don't get me hurt, he said. She'll be, when she gets the chores done, she'll come in and rustle up a little grub for lunch, he said. So I was sitting there talking for about 2 hours, drinking coffee and telling lies. And, and all of a sudden we heard a shot, and Mrs. Campbell shot the wolf. She was out there cleaning the barn, and she heard the sheep bells coming, looked out the back door. There was an old 30-30 hanging there, and the stock had been busted all wrapped up with wire, I don't know, a half a penny for a front sight or something. An old beat up old gun, she sticks that out in the back door and kills the wolf. I never heard the last of that. But there's lots, you know, all good people up in that country. Marty Allen, he owns their old Burnt Ranch and Campbell's and the Love Brothers and Jack Lee. I knew all them old packers and trappers and guides. And Jesus, you couldn't go past the place without stopping. If you went past the place without stopping, it'd be heck. You know, you had to come in and have lunch or coffee.
Yeah.
The door was always open, and just good people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's what the new age is different. You know. Things aren't the same.
Yeah.
Well, that was 16 years of, it was a good job, and lots of, lots of tough times sometimes, and, you know, in the cold weather. And I just had two-wheel drive.
Mm-hmm.
And with a toboggan for pulling meat on.
Yeah.
And a pair of snowshoes.
Yeah.
And there were two of us.
Mm-hmm.
And now there's 19 of them here.
Yeah.
All driving a $40,000 vehicle.
Yeah.
They're all trained in the back in the summertime, and the snowmobile in the back in the wintertime.
Yeah.
And a winch on the front.
Yeah.
And if looks a little tough, they hire a helicopter to go and check out something.
So you worked as a predator control office in, when did you say?
52 to 66.
Mm-hmm. And your main, do you have, you basically, did you go out and do studies and then limit, cut down the number of animals if there were too many predators, or how did that work?
Well, I did all the moose counts in the Super Cub. Willie Harrison owned Dominique Airways, and every winter we did the moose count in the Super Cub. Counted how many moose, and then it wasn't up to me. They had a biologist in Prince George, but we'd give them the figures.
Mm-hmm.
How many moose you saw that winter, and how many deer. And we just kept the wolves under control. When the wolves got thick in certain areas, we'd kill them like that. Like in the, when I started in 1950, there was 270, we did a caribou hunt in the top of the mountains in 1952, and there were 252 caribou in the top of the mountains, and lots of wolves. So we cleaned the wolves out of there the first time. There was lots of caribou kills on Moosekin, Johnny Lake, and wherever they were killed, but we beat them. We cleaned the walls out of the top of the mountains the first winter. And then they closed the season. They had the season closed for about 10 years in the top of the mountains. And when I quit in 1966, we did another caribou hunt. There was 107 caribou in the top of the mountains in 1952. And when I did the last count in 66, there was over 270.
Mm-hmm.
We've gone up by over 100 head because we cleaned the wolves out.
Yep.
And the caribou are all gone now. They put collars on a few. Last winter they thought they might have had eight caribou left.
Mm-hmm.
Where the hell did they all go to? And then the biologists say they all migrate. So a girl in the Shimmel one day did an interview about the early days and what happened in the early days. She said that, well, the biologists say that those, all those 270 head of caribou, they all migrated.
Mm-hmm.
She said, what do you think? Do you agree with that? And I said, yeah, the biologists are right, they migrated. And I said, they all migrated 3 feet. From one end of the wolf to the other. And that's about two.
Yeah.
And I said, that's where the caribou are.
Yeah.
There's none left. There's only half a dozen caribou left in the top of the mountains. Well, that's just an excuse of, you know, just mismanagement. They couldn't kill, they hadn't killed a wolf in 20 years up there.
Yeah.
And this friend of mine, Sonny Lester, he can tell you the same story, her and some other. We were up there hiking the Hunter Basin 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And they watched a pack of seven wolves come down off a mountain and chase a bunch of goats. And they run a goat down into a draw there and kill them right in front of them, above timberline. So they're killing lots of goats as well as caribou, but they won't kill any wolves. Up in the Yukon, it's different. The Yukon says, you know, in the Yukon for the last couple of years, they've been killing maybe 50 or 100 wolves by helicopter every winter because there was a caribou herd up there with, it used to be up in tens of thousands, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And the wolves were killing so many that all the native people in there, they depend on the caribou for winter feed, food. And so even everybody agreed, you know, if we don't do something, we're not going to have any caribou left. You know, they're killing so many, the wolves are getting thicker and the caribou are going down.
Mm-hmm.
So they started killing wolves, and now the caribou herd's starting to grow again.
As a predator control officer, did you mainly just do wolves? Or
yeah, well, bears. I shot 11 bears in 2 nights at the command. Because the bears, the people's problem. Down commander, there's no road. It's only 7 miles of road from commander down to the dock.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the only road they got. And all of, there was a couple hundred people in all of a sudden. All was in 1960, I guess. But the dump was down there by the ocean, and people drive down there at night and feed the bears chocolate bars and ice cream cones. You know, the bears get some tea.
Yeah.
And then the bears started coming into town. And this one guy looked out the window in the morning, and there was a black bear eating out of a garbage can. Kept going, and he's had his head in there, and his 2-year-old girl is petting the bear.
Yeah.
Because she thought it was a dog.
Yeah.
So he phoned my boss in Victoria. And Al West said, well, he said, you're not going to be very popular because people are split with bears and their pets, and they, that's all the entertainment they have is keeping the bears. He said, we wait and don't do anything. Some kid gets killed, and then they'll all be screaming to kill them all.
Yep.
So he said, you have to go down there and kill them. They knew how many bears there was because everyone had to come off their leg.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, you got to go down there and kill every bear. So I went down and I took the game warden from Terrace with me. And the boy went into the cookhouse there with their uniforms on, and they knew what we'd come for, I guess. And
yep.
Getting some pretty nasty remarks.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's your job.
Yeah.
So I got 7 bears the first night, and the second night I got the last 4.
Mm-hmm.
And we went up, and Dave owned the Duke, back and forth, went up, and the guy that was a Rod, remember the Rod and Gunpowder, and it's his daughter was petting a bear. He asked the same for coffee.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a uniform gun, and we went in to this guy's house for coffee. And the woman next door, come running out in the yard, and she's screaming and hollering, calling me a dirty murderer, and shot all our friends, she said. She's wailing and hollering.
Mm-hmm.
I said, look, baby, I said, maybe you've got 10 kids and you don't mind losing a couple, but this guy's got 1 and he wants to keep us. So
yeah.
She shut up and went back to the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
That's the attitude.
Yeah.
But if some kid got killed, you don't worry as long as it's not their kid.
Mm-hmm.
But stupid. They just, there's no fault they support them bears, feeding them.
Yeah.
But people do that all the time. I don't know.
Well, when you worked as the predator control officer, what was the main way that you disposed of them? Did you shoot them, poison them? How did you?
Oh, bears?
Both bears and
wolves. Oh, wolves. Most poison bitten all the wolves.
Mm-hmm.
And the bears are shot. But now they bring in a bear trap and catch them,
mm-hmm.
and tranquilize them and put a tag on them,
mm-hmm.
and spend maybe $1,000 on a helicopter to fly him out to Bobby Neck or something, and a month later he's back again.
Yep.
Because they proved out of commando. They had a grizzly bear at commando years ago. After I quit, they wouldn't shoot him, they started airlifting.
Mm-hmm.
And tied a grizzly bear in commando and put a tag on him and a collar, and they flew him into Tweedman Park. It's up over that range of mountains into Tweedman Park.
Mm-hmm.
And that bear, in a month, he was back on the garbage dump in commando.
Yeah.
Came back over the top of the mountains.
Yeah.
I guess he threw a little sketch of the route over the hill. He called when he came back.